and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. None of us expected the COVID-19 pandemic to last this long. We are all sick of masks, tired of restrictions, and certainly tired of hearing about people dying. Some predict that we're turning the corner on the pandemic with the Omicron variant peaking in some parts of the country, yet in Wisconsin, we continue to set records. Here to talk to us today about the future of the virus and what we can expect in the weeks and months to come is Department of Health Services Secretary-designee Karen Timberlake and DHS Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ryan Westergaard. Thank you both for joining us.
You are very welcome.
Okay. Well, I think we want to start out today looking at kind of where we're at. So we have a slide showing the hospitalizations and ICU bed utilization across Wisconsin and kind of the trends that we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks. Secretary Timberlake, when you look at that data, what is that story that it's telling?
Right. What I think people really need to be paying attention to is the fact that we still have a very significant number of people in our hospitals with COVID-19. And so what that means is that our hospitals are really stretched and stressed to provide care, not only for the people who have COVID-19, but for any of the rest of us who have any other healthcare needs. Just to give some quick context to it, about 8 weeks ago, on November 24th, there were 1,278 people in the hospital with COVID-19. Today, there are more than 2,000, so 2,021. And we've had just this rapid growth kind of week over week. One tiny little bright spot is from about 7 days ago to today, we have seen a decline in hospitalizations. So as we all know, takes more than 1 week of anything happening with this pandemic to really call that a trend. But I think that, you know, part of what we have been really calling attention to, and certainly what our healthcare providers around the state have been calling attention to, is the fact that as we are asking our doctors, our nurses, our respiratory care technicians, everyone working in a healthcare setting to go through now a third winter of caring for people with COVID-19, the stress and strain on them is considerable, and we all need to be doing what we can do to prevent that next case of COVID, that next hospitalization.
It sure is nice to hear you talk about a little bit of a bright spot. Dr. Westergaard, I'm sure you've been asked this question many times. Everybody is eager for the answer every day. Are we turning the corner on the Omicron variant like they're seeing in other parts of the country?
We hope so. There's certainly, we look at the epidemic curve here using our Wisconsin data, and we're dialed into national data and other data from other regions as well. And it does seem like there's a corner being turned. Some of the states, particularly in the Northeast, have seen a couple of weeks now of decreased case numbers. I think what Secretary Timberlake said, though, deserves to be amplified, like the total number of sick people in the hospitals right now and the capacity of our hospitals is a pretty dire situation. But I think there's a way to look at our current data and see an optimistic view and see a great deal of progress as well. And so when you look at our total number of people in the hospital, the number of ICUs, they're high. They're about as high as they were in November of 2020. And that's putting a lot of strain on everybody. But when you look at the total number of cases, the total number of people who are becoming sick due to the much more highly transmissible Omicron variant, that's about twice as high as it's ever been. So there's more virus in the state than we've ever seen. The number of people requiring hospital care is proportionally lower. And that's for a couple of reasons. Why I think that's good to know about is because it really reflects the progress we've made in medical science and particularly vaccination. We have so many more tools that we have now in 2022 than we had in 2020 to keep people out of the hospital and to keep people from getting very, very sick. And COVID-19 vaccines are number one on that list. We also have some therapeutics. We've also had new treatment modalities in hospitals to reduce the death rate from COVID-19. But I think I like to look at both sides. Yes, the situation is very dire. Our hospitals under a lot of strain and transmission is very, very high. But people should also know that we've got a lot of power that we didn't used to have to prevent disease. And for people that haven't been vaccinated, that's one of our biggest messages. Yes, there's a lot of virus, but we can save lives. We can continue to save lives by encouraging vaccination as we have all along.
You know, you talk about the high number of Omicron cases and how that's so much higher than before. Certainly a lot of people have contracted the virus over the last month or several weeks. And I think they're feeling good about their level of immunity. What can you say about immunity from Omicron? Will that actually protect us from any future variants or perhaps a resurgence of the more dangerous Delta variant?
We certainly hope so, but there's an element to the to this epidemic that is very unpredictable. And we've learned just recently, there's some studies from last week that compared the immune response from the Delta variant to Omicron, and it looks different. Certainly anyone who has antibodies against this virus, either from a COVID-19 vaccine or from a previous infection, is going to be protected to some degree. They'll be better off than if they are immunologically naive, if you will, never having been exposed to the virus or a vaccine. But the degree of protection, how much that protects us to future variants that might come in the future, is really hard to say. The hope is that it's going to always provide some protection against very severe disease. But when we see new variants, what that means is that there's actually variation in the structure of the virus. And so antibodies might not bind as quickly. So we're certainly hopeful, but what we're living through right now with the Omicron variant was a very important lesson that we can't get too comfortable, that you know, Mother Nature can still throw curveballs and come up with things that we haven't seen before. And Omicron surprised all of us by how different it was compared to Delta and Alpha and other variants. And that translated to a really different epidemic in terms of the magnitude and the speed that it's spreading.
Secretary Timberlake, this might be a question for you. Following what's kind of happening in the legislature, the Republican legislature recently introducing some bills that would regard immunity as equivalent to vaccination, that it should be counted the same. Do you have a reaction to that?
Well, certainly, you know, the governor will take a good hard look at anything that the legislature sends his way. I think my best answer to that question, Lisa, would be to underscore what Dr. Westergaard just said about the fact that this virus continues to be endlessly creative and, you know, it's in the business of survival. So it wants to continue to find new people to infect, and it wants to continue to evolve and mutate so that it can continue to infect more people. And so, you know, I'm reminded of certainly what our own clinical experts, as well as national clinical experts, have been reminding us, which is that vaccination continues to be your best protection against the coronavirus, and that it's really in everybody's interest to get vaccinated and to stay safe from this virus. Even if you don't think that you yourself will get terribly sick, you are around other people in your lives who may or may not respond the same way that you do. And every new infection is an opportunity for a new mutation. And so I think all of those things really just underscore the need to get not just vaccinated, but also to get that booster dose when you're eligible.
You know, speaking of new concerns, I know that last week the department, along with the governor, announced a new initiative focused on kids. I believe you've said that 1 in 5 new cases is with youth. We have some data showing the weekly COVID case rate for youth and kind of the trends there, as that also is going up at an alarming rate. What can you say about what's happening with kids? We'll talk with Secretary Timberlake and then Dr. Westergaard.
Sure. So just to start off the conversation, just as you noted, Lisa, and as the data really does show, really since the beginning of last fall, we have seen just this dramatic increase in COVID infections among kids. It's really important for people to know that every child ages 5 and up now is eligible to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. And we really strongly recommend that every parent, every guardian, every caretaker, talk with your child's pediatrician and get your child vaccinated as soon as you can. It may seem that, and folks may have heard, that there are many kids who do pretty well with COVID, particularly with Omicron. That said, we've had more than 2,200, I believe, young people under the age of 20. I can't quite call them all kids, but young people under the age of 20 who have been hospitalized due to COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. And if you're a parent whose child has ever needed inpatient care for any reason, you know how scary that can be, you know how disruptive it can be, and it's just not a gamble that I think any of us really want to be taking for our kids. We also know that, and a big part of the communication and the toolkit, the resources that we put out last week are focused around keeping kids safe from coronavirus and keeping them in school. We know that for our school-age kids, having too many more semesters that are at least partially disrupted by COVID-19 is challenging for them. And we all want a school year that is as normal, as uninterrupted as it can be. And the best way to do that is to get kids vaccinated, to send them to school in masks, to support your school district when it asks for kids and staff and teachers to be wearing masks, to follow those isolation and quarantine rules. All of those things are going to keep our kids safe and in school, which is just the best thing for them in the short run as well as the long run.
Dr. Westergaard, can you talk a little bit about what's happening with kids? I think we've seen some of our children's hospitals really seeing higher hospitalizations and use of ICU beds as well. Is that right?
Yes, we saw even as far back as the summer and early fall, we saw some interesting things with increased hospitalizations from a number of respiratory viruses, not just COVID. And it really told a story about how this last 2 years has really upended a lot of what we've come to understand and expect about how viruses spread in our community. We were seeing viruses like RSV that are usually seen in the middle of winter, in late summer. And so there's been a lot of things that have been unpredictable. The thing that I think we find discouraging or disappointing that we're living through this unprecedented surge in COVID-19 cases is that we do seem to have lost a little bit of our vigilance in protecting kids. And I think one of the things that I've been watching closely is how many school districts have gone back with mask optional or not wearing masks at all. And that really makes me sad when, as a parent of physician and a scientist, what we've learned about the benefit that simple measures like mask wearing can have, and to see people want to leave some of those tools on the shelf has really, I think, put us in a bad position. We've had a lot more transmission in households, in families, and in schools themselves as a result of that, and it's contributed to our overall size of our epidemic. So I think, this is not going to last forever. I don't think students are going to be asked or expected to wear masks, past this school year, we hope. But right now is a moment where there's so much virus going around. We can cut that down a little bit. We can get some relief to our healthcare system and keep people from coming down with COVID, from having to stay home from school by wearing masks in school and to keep pressing our goals and encouraging vaccination. This is, the schools have been so disrupted, but we have things we can do to make them less so. And I think it's really a coming together moment where if we could apply a little bit more diligence, a little bit more attention to some of these things, we could be doing better.
Secretary, you talked a little bit about this earlier, that we're in this twofold crisis. We have hospitals filling up, ICU units filling up, and then we also have this healthcare workforce crisis. I know that the state has put some energy into this with some targeted recruitment of nurses and healthcare workers, and the governor commissioning National Guard soldiers to be trained and placed in nursing homes and other facilities. Can you talk a little bit about how those efforts are going and if they're actually helping?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So Governor Evers and we, together with our partners at the Department of Military Affairs, we just have been so fortunate to be working with our volunteers in the Wisconsin National Guard. They have been with us from day one of the pandemic. They were some of the very, they did some of the very first COVID testing that was done in the state. They did some of the very first community vaccination clinics that were done. And so it's not a surprise that when we needed them to step in and really help out in terms of expanding our capacity and our whole healthcare continuum, the Guard was really right there. So what the governor announced just in the last week or so is that we are adopting several different strategies to work on really shoring up healthcare staffing, as you noted, Lisa. One of those is to ask Guard members to take a rapid CNA training class, certified nursing assistant training class, and go and work under supervision in skilled nursing facilities. And the reason to do that is that by shoring up the staffing and the capacity in our skilled nursing facilities, we can create more opportunity for patients who are really ready to leave the hospital, but not quite ready to go home. Create more opportunities for them to have a safe place to be cared for. So we're doing that initially with some volunteers who either had already taken or are taking that rapid class and are going in with supervision. We then have another group of National Guard volunteers who are in training as we speak at Madison College, and they are going through the full 75-hour CNA training program, and they similarly will be available in just by the end of the month here in January to go out and create even more capacity, again, in our nursing homes, which will help our hospitals. And then a kind of third part of the skilled nursing strategy and the CNA strategy is working with our partners in the two long-term care associations, particularly with the support of the Wisconsin Healthcare Association. We actually are running a whole accelerated training program through them where we will train up another, could be as many as 2,000 people, not National Guard folks, just people who are interested in becoming CNAs. And then on the hospital side of things, more directly, or on the kind of direct staffing support side of the line, the state has engaged with a large number of staffing agencies, people who help hospitals and sometimes long-term care source staff during various staffing shortages. And we, as of today, have placed over 660 staff. So that's everything from physicians, nurses, CNAs, therapists, et cetera, in hospitals, as well as some skilled nursing and some assisted living facilities across the state. And we will continue with that strategy for as long as we need to.
You know, the Hospitals Association says that throughout COVID that they've seen a 30% increase in the rate of people leaving the healthcare profession. Do you feel this is a point in time crisis, or is this something we're gonna have to deal with for a long time, and what are some long-term solutions?
Right. I'm happy to speak to that initially, and I'd love Dr. Westergaard's thoughts, since I don't do any direct patient care, and certainly he'll have a different perspective. You know, I think certainly we have been seeing those trends here in Wisconsin, reflected also around the country. This has just been a time of historic challenge for anyone in a direct caregiving kind of profession. And so I think that while we can certainly hope that, again, that turnover, that decline is going to stabilize as COVID itself stabilizes and as this sort of feeling of living in constant crisis starts to subside. With that said, no doubt, to your point, this amount of transition is creating the need to really build that pipeline of people who are looking to make a career change, or college students who haven't picked yet, or high school students who are just thinking about. And so certainly Governor Evers and our colleagues at the Department of Workforce Development have a whole set of strategies designed to really help to build that healthcare workforce pipeline. And I'm quite sure that that's something we're going to want to be continuing to talk about as we head into the next biennial budget cycle as well.
Dr. Westergaard, are you concerned about this critical shortage going long-term?
Well, I think the long-term long-term perspective really requires that we acknowledge that this has really been traumatic, that there's a lot of healing that's going to need to go on among people in our professions. What hasn't changed, in my view, and I take a sense of responsibility to say this, is that medicine and healthcare and nursing is the best profession a person could go into. I still believe that, and although it's been hard, and we've seen over and over again that people's personal resources to continue to work in this environment are wells of compassion and resilience, aren't infinite. But it still is a wonderful way to serve our communities, to serve our state. And I'm encouraged that, we're still seeing high numbers of people applying for medical school and nursing school, and people still realize that this is a wonderful career opportunity. And I think those of us that have been through this, one of the lessons that we've learned is that we need to support ourselves and our colleagues emotionally and materially, in ways that we probably took for granted in the past, to help us remain resilient. And those of us that have endured through this, I think we'll be stronger for it. But it's going to be really important to explicitly acknowledge that this has been a real trauma on those of us who have had to watch people die, have had to work with not enough resources, have been various stages of burning out ourselves. And I think I'm hopeful for the future that this will always be, an amazing calling and career choice for people. But we have to recognize that it's going to take some time for us to recover from this and to build our strength collectively back in the health professions. But I'm very optimistic that we'll do that.
Speaking of lack of resources, the capacity of Wisconsin's public health system has been something of a concern even prior to the pandemic. I'm interested, First Secretary Timberlake, in your thoughts on that and whether or not our system was actually prepared for a pandemic like this.
So one of the things that I think we have learned over the last several years is that it is so essential that we have a strong local public health infrastructure for a variety of reasons, some of them obvious and some of them less so. The obvious ones might be that, folks may have come to rely upon a testing site or a vaccination site that is at least sponsored in part by their local public health department. I know many of our employers have benefited from on-site vaccination clinics. Certainly, as we have had major outbreaks in places of employment or educational settings, we rely on local public health to go in and investigate all of that. And I'm sure that if you talk to our local public health leaders all across the state, they would tell you that they have been very challenged to keep up with the volume of demand. And so we've done everything we can at a state level to really supplement and complement what local public health can do with vendor supports and with additional staffing kinds of contracts for, vaccination clinics and testing as well. But at the end of the day, the thing that we can't as easily bring in from the outside is those local relationships and that power that public health has to really be a convener and to pull everyone in a community, however that's defined, city, county, village, neighborhood, pull that community together around what's going on in the community and what needs to be done and what everybody can do to help address a problem, in this case, COVID-19. So I think no question, public health has stepped up amazingly. No question that same stress and strain and trauma that Dr. Westergaard talked about in the healthcare sector is affecting public health as well. And I think that we're all going to take a great number of lessons away around what it looks like to have a public health response and really even an emergency response around something that is statewide and in fact national and global, not sort of more localized and isolated. I think we had a system that was well built for the localized, isolated, contaminated well or tornado or fire or flood. This is a disaster, a public health disaster of just an entirely different scale. So we've all been running as fast as we can, and I know there will be many lessons learned.
certainly greater appreciation for the role of public health, I think, by a lot of people. Another crisis I want to quickly touch on to understand where we might go is the mental health crisis, particularly among youth. I know the recent report from the Office of Children's Mental Health showed some real concerns around increasing depression, anxiety, even suicide attempts among our youth. What, Dr. Westergaard, do you want to talk a little bit about a long-term strategy around dealing with mental health issues, particularly of children, but for all of us?
I think there was certainly some of these trends happening even before the pandemic, and we've seen increases in the so-called diseases of despair, drug overdoses, and interpersonal violence even for a few years now. So I think this is something that we really need to look at through a public health lens, through our, you know, using all the tools of science, both epidemiology and social science, to really understand what is it about our society that seems to be coming in many ways less well, less resilient? And is it our relationships? Is it the information that we're consuming? Is it political discourse? All of these things, I think, are open questions of the ways that they're impacting our collective mental health across the lifespan. And as a scientist, I don't think that there are easy answers, but I think we need to look at this through the same lens that we look at something like a viral pandemic. What are the root causes? What are sources? Where are examples of resilience and healing, and what made the difference in those communities and those individuals? Mental health is health, and we need to use same evidence-based strategies to support one another, to understand what is going on, and to use strategies that can restore people to health. So I don't know that we have all the answers, but I think we've got great capacity, and we have great people in public servants and science and medicine and public health, that if we use the tools that we have, the scientific tools, the communication tools, and the ability to create a strategy to look really in a broad sense of what determines health and well-being, that we can address this in the same way that we address really complicated biomedical problems like cancer and all the things that we use really sophisticated tools in hospitals. So I think that's the first step, is just acknowledging that we need to approach mental health as public health and go where the situation takes us and what we learn.
And Lisa, Secretary, I can tag on to that, Yvette, with just a couple of resources that I would really want all your viewers to be aware of. So the Office of Children's Mental Health itself maintains a great collection and repository of resources, including things like a feelings thermometer that can help parents kind of get into these conversations with their kids, and to Dr. Westergaard's point, help us all check in with ourselves and one another as well. In addition, the Department of Health Services has been curating a whole set of resources under the banner Resilient Wisconsin. And so that's another good kind of starting point for people who may be just appreciating the cumulative effect of what the pandemic has meant for all of us. And then third, and definitely by no means least important, I think for any parent of a child or a young adult who's got concerns, a great first stop is your primary care provider, your pediatrician, somebody who can really help you get an assessment of that child and their circumstances and help connect you to resources. There are resources available, and it is really important to check in and to be accessing those whenever you feel the need to.
Thank you for sharing those resources. We've also been sharing on the screen as we close out today resources on where you can access testing in your community or order testing, as well as access vaccine resources in your community. I wanted to ask both of you really quickly if you could wrap up. Are you seeing a time in the near future where schools can return to more normal activities, where we can take the masks off, where people will return to the office? Do you see that time in our near future? First, Dr. Westergaard, then Secretary Timberlake.
Yes, absolutely. This is not going to last forever. We see as recently as late last summer, we had transmission that was considered low in many areas, and I'm fully confident we'll get there again, and we'll know more about how to respond if and when we get more disease in the future. But yes, this wave will not last forever.
Yep, and I would certainly agree with that. And I'll also just give a shout out to our public schools, and I'm sure our private schools as well across the state. I am the parent of a high school student, and I can tell you that schools are working really hard to have things be as back to normal as they possibly can be for kids. Here in the workplace, you know, we were joking at the top of the call, Lisa, about sort of the pluses and minuses of the virtual environment, but I think we've all settled into a hybrid work environment in some ways that, again, are actually positive for the way that work gets done, the way we're able to connect people. And so while the things that we all think of as the restrictions and the limitations of the pandemic, I certainly agree with Dr. Westergaard, are going to go by the wayside, I really do want to celebrate the good work that's being done to have life be as much like the Wisconsin way of life that we all know and love as it can be every day.
Well, thank you both for ending on that note of hope, and thank you both for joining us. Thank you also to the viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to turn in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make an impact on all of us.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.